From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
It's all part of the same conversation, you know? There have been a lot of ugly truths we've all been living with, and we're at a point now, I think, where we're starting to be willing to look at them.
The Harvey Weinstein revelations broke when Susanna Grant was already writing her Netflix series, Unbelievable, based on a true story about how one team of cops pursued a serial rapist while another disbelieved and bullied a victim. In the hectic aftermath of the Weinstein exposés, Netflix asked Grant, "Does this change anything about your project?" She said, "No." Grant tells us about the challenge of turning a news story from ProPublica and the Marshall Project into a scripted series. She also shares her thoughts on how to depict rape on screen and talks about what she did and did not discuss with the victim whose story is at the heart of the series. But first on the news banter, Peacock struts into a crowded field. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So all we talk about now is the new streaming services. That's it. We're going to change the name of the show to the streaming services. So that's it. So we already have, obviously, Netflix came in and really has a humongous advantage in terms of how many subscribers it has, even if it's not adding them as quickly as projected. We have other companies, the old guard media companies, betting the farm on their new streaming services. Warner Media is doing HBO Max. Disney is doing their Disney Plus for $7 a month. These things, the price points are all over the place. This is going to be a tricky one for consumers until it somehow gets sorted out. We have Apple, of course. They're new into it and coming with $5 a month or free if you have a new Apple device. So there's all kinds of confusion, I think, for consumers. But to make it worse or better, depending on how you see this thing, NBC now has Peacock that they are launching. They're coming late into the game. The price of this for people who are not Comcast subscribers, because NBC is, Uni is owned by Comcast, is not going to be clear, but it is going to be a different model, an ad-supported model. I don't know. I hear a fair bit of skepticism in the industry, but they're going to throw a lot of money at this.
Yeah, and the key thing here is that NBCU is owned by Comcast, and Comcast comes at this from a very specific perspective. They have 20 million cable subscribers in the U.S. They want to keep those subscribers, and they're going to give away the ad-supported version of Peacock to those subscribers in an effort to keep them. That's great business for them, in my opinion, because it's a value add. It's essentially saying, we're going to give you all this other stuff that we're putting exclusively on the streamer if you stay a subscriber and don't cut the cord. There's going to be a paid tier as well, so you can get it without commercials, and that might be alluring to some. But this is an ad-driven, for the most part, service, and it's distinguished from some of the others like Netflix and Disney Plus and Apple Plus, all these others that are trying to create a subscription ad-free video service.
So to lure people, NBC Universal bought The Office back from itself at a very high price. I mean, this is a tremendous bonanza for anybody who has, I think almost anybody who has an old show. NBC Uni is talking about doing reboots of Battlestar Galactica, Saved by the Bell, Punky Brewster. That's what the world's been waiting for, remake Punky Brewster. But they are also going to do some originals, they say. Mike Schur, who did The Good Place, Parks and Rec, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, he's going to be doing dramas. Sam Ismail, who did Mr. Robot, is going to create programming, one of which is based on a Hollywood Reporter article about Angeline, the woman who drives around in a pink car with big hair. So just to disclose that our company has a little teeny piece of this, a very teeny piece. Yeah, I mean, they do have these weapons. They can, you know, they can use the Olympics to promote this. It's just amusing to hear this person who's going to run this, Bill McGoldrick. You know, they of course you say, well, how are you going to break out from the pack? Oh, we're going to have noisy original programming. That is an amazing good strategy. Everybody should follow that model.
Yeah, that's essentially saying we want shows people will talk about, which means good shows, which means popular shows. I think, you know, for all the talk that has been out there about how many of these streaming services will survive and are consumers really ready to pay for more than three or four of these services, by this time next year, we will have a very good answer to that question because these are all launching within the next 6 months. There will be a streaming service from Warner Media called HBO Max that people may or may not pay extra on top of their HBO subscription to get. There will be a Comcast, NBC Universal add-on, there will be Apple, there will be Disney, there will be the existing players, Hulu, Amazon, Netflix.
Help.
This is starting to look like a cable subscription. And ultimately, it will be a 21st century version of that. But we're in this transition period right now where people are spending like crazy to try to distinguish their streaming service, but while also keeping up these cable channels that are in decline.
Yeah, speaking of in decline, AT&T, as we, I think, talked about before, Elliott Management Corp, which is an activist shareholder group, has been very critical of AT&T's various acquisitions, including DirecTV and what was Time Warner is now Warner Media, HBO, Warner Brothers, all of that. They are leaning on AT&T, and AT&T is looking at the sale, potentially, of DirecTV. This is a weird bet that AT&T made. They decided to buy DirecTV for $49 billion in 2015 at this moment when prices were high and people were really starting to cut the cord on their satellite subscriptions. So I don't know who's going to buy it. Potentially they sell it to Dish if they can get past the antitrust people, which honestly, with the declining business, I don't know if it's worth fighting this on antitrust grounds. But, you know, they're going to take a bit of a bath if they do sell it, I think, right?
Oh, a huge bath. I mean, the consensus among analysts is that AT&T bought DirecTV at the height of the satellite TV market. And it's only been downhill since then. And the business, as AT&T itself acknowledges with its HBO Max streaming service, is going a different direction from the traditional pay TV services. So, you know, that's a big rebuke of the management of AT&T that they spent so much on this asset. In a larger sense, the critics are coming after the strategy as a whole, turning AT&T from a telecom into a fully integrated media content production and distribution company. That is the most interesting thing to watch because it's DirecTV now, but how long until people come after AT&T for buying Time Warner? That's what the interesting thing
will be. Well, it's already happened. Elliot is already complaining about it and complaining that the person who's been chosen to run it, John Stankey, is the wrong guy. So they're already under fire.
And they're under fire for not having more experienced entertainment people running these assets. But I think most of the energy right now is surrounding DirecTV. I wouldn't be surprised if it also gets put on the Time Warner assets and they start to say, hey, does it make sense for a traditional telephone company to be in the film and TV business?
Yeah, risky business. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new Netflix series Unbelievable, based on a true story, begins in 2008 with 18-year-old Marie, a young woman struggling to overcome a childhood of abuse and multiple foster homes. Played by Caitlin Dever, Marie is living in her first apartment outside Seattle when a masked man breaks in and assaults her at knife point. When she reports her rape to the police, she has to recount the details again and again and again at her home, at the hospital, and at the police station. A couple of Marie's former foster moms try to be supportive, but privately they wonder if Marie made up the story, just seeking attention. When one of them shares her doubts with the police, two detectives call the traumatized Marie back into the station and lay out their suspicions.
And then there's the crime scene. I mean, we couldn't find any physical evidence there was anyone else in your apartment that night.
But there was.
Marie, I want to be really clear about something. We don't think you're a bad person.
Absolutely not.
And I also don't think this was some big thought-out thing. But given the inconsistencies in your story and the lack of evidence, this is becoming a puzzle that is hard for us to piece together.
Under pressure from the police and lacking support, Marie just wants the ordeal to end. She recants her rape report with devastating consequences. But a few years later, two Colorado detectives, played by Merritt Weaver and Toni Collette, make an unlikely discovery. Though they work in different cities that have no system for sharing information, they learn by chance that they're very likely looking for the same guy, a masked rapist who breaks into the homes of women who live alone. The two cops start comparing notes.
What else did you learn from your victim besides the birthmark?
He speaks four languages. He's visited the Philippines, Korea, Thailand.
Possible military.
Yep.
Unbelievable is based on a 2015 Pulitzer Prize-winning article by ProPublica and the Marshall Project. When screenwriter and director Susanna Grant first read that piece, she instantly knew she wanted to adapt it for the screen. Grant has told stories of real people before. She was nominated for Oscar for writing Erin Brockovich, and she wrote HBO's Anita Hill movie, Confirmation. Before she did any of that, Grant got a job writing about another real person in an animated Disney version. Pocahontas was the first job.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of the AFI film school.
I had won the Nickel Fellowship, which is a fellowship. It's a good thing. And then Disney Animation, they became early fans, I guess. And they kept bringing me in to talk about movies that I just, like, I had a feeling like you're never really going to make this. And I was still in school, so I just stayed
in school.
Was
it animated? Did they sort of
say animated ones.
I mean, like, were you wanting to be animated?
I was wanting to work. I was wanting to get going and make movies. But then they said, are you interested in Pocahontas? We have a release date. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that one for sure.
So that's going, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, did you also look for live action stuff or you just somehow?
Yeah. I was, you know, I was...
You were
going on a bunch of meetings, and I was young, and I had really good guidance. I had really good mentors. My writing teacher was fantastic, and he connected me to a couple other people. And I would say, what about this one? And people who had been writers for 20, 30 years would say, never going to get made. Don't do it. Stay in school. And I had, you know, I'd figured out my money for the year, so I wasn't...
It was good advice,
everybody I knew said, hold out. You'll get something that feels like it'll actually make a difference and be interesting to you to do and be more than just a paycheck and a movie that sits unmade forever.
Right.
So that was good advice.
So you work on Pocahontas. I read something that I thought was funny about how you saw the drawing and they had like hot body Pocahontas and you were kind of like,
Well, here's the thing. She's very... strong. Like, yes, you could view her as hot or you could view her as
But
as
you wrote,
strong.
What I read was you wrote to define her as strong because you didn't want her to be like...
Yeah, I mean, I was one of three writers. So Philip Lesepnik and Carl Binder were my partners. So, you know, we all saw the same picture. She was drawn by the time we got there. And I felt it was really important to show that that body was hers, you know, and that she looked the way she did because she had strength and athleticism. And so that's why we... introduced her diving off that cliff and canoeing and, you know, somebody who dives and canoes, they look like that. You know?
It's amazing having a woman in the room maybe changes things sometimes.
Sometimes it does.
Yeah. And then let's talk a minute about Erin Brockovich because you had to kind of work your way into that one.
I did. Yeah. I had Ever After, I don't think was out yet, but was about to be released, and I went to talk to somebody at Jersey Pictures, and she told me she described Erin to me, and I immediately thought, whatever that is, I want to do that. And I don't know if these names are right, but I think they were out to Callie Curry, and then I called up, and they were out to Scott Frank. These are all people really like and have a lot of respect for, and you know, slowly, I'm sure they were busy with other work, and I think it was just like a steady, polite persistence. And then eventually they said, well, let's put you together with Erin and see how that fits. And that was great.
You like dress carefully?
I didn't know how she dressed.
Well, no, I wasn't really specifically referencing her. Just like it was a big moment of meeting someone you wanted to get along with.
I just try to show up as me.
Just to be
yourself, know?
Exactly. Right? If I really wanted to do a project like that and I'm meeting the woman and she's got the approval, I think I'd be pretty nervous.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at it with the hindsight of it being...
a huge deal.
A big movie, and a big movie for me and a big movie for a lot of people. At the time, it was a
That's
job.
True. At the time,
you
it
know,
was like
it was
some
job.
Lady.
No one had ever heard of her. She
That's
had
true.
An unfamiliar name, and then I... tucked in next to her at a, you know, at Cafe Med on Sunset, and we ended up staying for hours and laughing and really getting each other. So I think Erin pushed me over the top on that one.
I'll just note the headline. There was a story from ABC: stay-at-home mom gets Oscar nod.
I know, isn't
nod.
That funny?
that is.
Yes.
I guess it's funny.
It was soccer mom, but no, stay-at-home.
Stay-at-home.
Great.
Yeah. So let's turn to Unbelievable, obviously based on a real story. I mean, it's amazing. This is a durable story because I was reading a Twitter thread, which was very complimentary to you, by one of the writers who wrote a story for ProPublica.
Ken Armstrong.
Ken Armstrong. And he was saying how well you did this story and how pleased
nice
he was.
Because,
of course, it was his story.
Yeah.
It was Marie's. It's many people have, you know, have became invested in how the story's told. And the story's been told... on This American Life. And
yeah, we're the fourth incarnation
of fourth
it.
Iteration. Yeah. And yet, you know.
Fifth. There was a TV thing as well. But one of those nightly magazine shows did it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So yet the story is so compelling. And it was in process before Harvey Weinstein, before the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
It was a thing that was already happening.
Yeah.
In fact, you guys had to kind of, I think, look at it and say, does this change anything about how we're telling the story?
Yeah, well, Netflix asked us that. They said, do you think this changes anything? And we said it didn't, you know? I don't think it did. I think this was not a new conversation, you
right.
know? This is a conversation...
It was building.
A lot of us have felt building well before Harvey. Yeah. It's all part of the same conversation. There have been a lot of ugly truths we've all been living with.
Yes.
And we're at a point now, I think, where we're starting to be willing to look at them.
Yes.
And they're uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable for a lot of people to look at. And they're not as simple as believe all women. You know, one of the detectives, the detective who is the inspiration for Merritt Weaver's character, says, what she does is listen to all women and verify.
Yes.
Because she's got to
well
have
put.
A
I like
case that.
That
stands up in court. So,
yes. And we have to get past legal.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the same as prosecuting somebody, but you can't publish.
Right.
Unless you can really stand up and say, I've got this.
Right. So I hope we're ready to have a more complicated conversation.
Yeah. So there was more than one party interested in the story, making the story into to something on the screen.
Yeah. Well, actually, there were a bunch of interested parties, but I brought it to Sarah Timberman. And at the same time, the novelists Michael Chabon and Aya Waldman did the same thing. So Sarah got it from...
They're a married couple.
Yeah, they're a married couple. So she got it from two different
How did she get
people.
It from two different?
Because she's great. And if you've worked with her... You want to work with her again,
okay.
And if you have difficult, complicated material that's you need help finding a really good home for it, she is the place to go. She had to deal with CBS Studios and called them up and said, this isn't your business model, this is a limited series, but David Staff there, to his credit, said, it's worth our while, it's worth doing. Yes, we're in. Let's find a buyer. And Sarah called Cindy Holland at Netflix, I think at 10 o'clock one morning, and by lunchtime, Cindy was in.
So there was not a lot of running around to this place.
Not a lot of running around, no.
And did it feel like Netflix to you? I mean, were you like, yes, Netflix,
it did, you know. I had not worked there before, but I liked the idea that they were making a big commitment to creative voices. And I also liked the fact that they're instantly in 190 countries, you know. I mean... The idea behind doing it was we could magnify it. We could amplify it.
Are you thinking it'll be this many episodes and it's, or does
it sort of fell into eight pretty quickly. And one of the great things was, you know, our friends at Netflix told us really quickly, most viewers at Netflix, they know, will stick around for that second episode if they like the first. So that meant that you don't have to introduce all your characters in the first hour. You can take the first hour and just tell one story. And I mean, we have Toni Collette in this, who's fantastic, and she doesn't show up until the very end of the second episode. And that's the kind of luxury I don't think you would have on a show where you're dropping one every week, you know?
Yes.
I mean, people will wait 2 hours for Toni, but they maybe won't wait 2 weeks for Toni. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I felt like that flexibility with storytelling was really fun.
Coming up after a short break, unbelievable showrunner Susanna Grant tells us about speaking to the real Marie. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Susanna Grant, showrunner of the new Netflix series, Unbelievable. Based on a true story, Unbelievable follows Colorado detectives Grace Rasmussen and Karen Duvall as they hunt for a serial rapist. The two women work for neighboring police departments that have no system for sharing information, so it's only by chance that they discover they may be looking for the same man. Frustrated by a perpetrator who's careful not to leave evidence, the two cops bring in an FBI agent. Duvall, played by Merritt Weaver, is grateful for the support, but Rasmussen, played by Toni Collette, is less so.
This man is helping us. This man is stepping
up. Okay. But where is his outrage? You know, where is the voice looking at this pattern saying, this is supremely f***ed up?
It is. But you sitting out here, screaming into the wind, does nothing to un-f*** it.
Even as Unbelievable follows the two cops, it also centers on a victim who was attacked far away in another state. 18-year-old Marie was raped in a Seattle suburb, but in her case, the police doubted her story. Marie is struggling to overcome a terrible childhood, and lacking support, she just wants a way out. She withdraws the rape report with terrible consequences, but in time, Marie's case and the Colorado investigation collide.
So, of course, I imagine one of the most difficult challenges. I mean, the depiction of rape.
I haven't seen many depictions of it that didn't feel voyeuristic. Mm-hmm. And it was really important to me that this not be voyeuristic.
So how do you achieve that?
It was interesting. I sat down to write it, and I was really it just felt physically in my body wrong to be writing it from an objective viewpoint. And then, you know, within the show, if you've seen it, the main character's narrative of the rape is actually important to the plot, you know, and the fact that it changes and the fact that it is inconsistent and has holes. So the combination of that and the idea that I didn't want to observe it, I wanted to feel it as she felt it, just sort of made it make sense to tell it all from her perspective. And then Lisa Cholodenko came in and she directed the first three episodes.
There was a question as to, you know, whether to make it so clear that this rape was real or make it like a mystery, which I think would have not worked. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, there are people who watch it and aren't sure that she's telling the truth. And I don't mind that at all, that we can make the audience complicit in that doubt, you know, because if you look at the statistics about sexual assault, it's so massively underreported and then so massively underprosecuted, and it's a life-altering crime. You don't end up with that kind of imbalance unless there's something going on culturally that we all have sort of unconsciously absorbed. And I was interested in that. I was interested in a character who was a part of that, not a villainous outlier, but one of us. Who's making...
This is the cop, of course.
The cop, yeah. The detective, mm-hmm. Lead detective, who's making a lot of the same mistakes that people we all know and love could make.
So did you speak to Marie? I think she uses a middle name, and that's what she does.
She goes by Marie.
The central character.
Yes, I did.
Beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
That has got to be a delicate conversation. It's like the character goes in the in your show, goes through multiple, tell me the story again, tell me the story again. And there you are, like, tell me the story again.
No, I did not ask her to tell me
you
the story
not.
Again.
Okay. Yeah.
She had told her story really clearly to Ken Armstrong and T. Miller, the journalists who reported it. She also told it to This American Life. I didn't need her to do that again. I called her and I told her of our intentions and kind of tried to tell her where my heart and mind were on the project and try to make her feel that her story was going to be represented with respect and integrity and just really to give her peace of mind. And then I asked her if I could call her with small questions thereafter, and she said absolutely anytime. So, you know, I ended up calling her with questions like, what kind of phone did you use? You know, she was incredibly generous. You know, this is not... She told this story a lot. She did not continue telling this story to journalists because she wanted to. She did it 100% because she didn't want this to happen to someone else, you know? And it's just so much respect for that woman.
Yeah. She has just said that watching the show really gave her some closure. So that must feel good.
It does feel good. It does. She actually said that the shot of him getting
the perpetrator
locked away.
Getting locked for away for
was
a really long time. Yeah.
Yeah, was meaningful to her. So
when you talk to your actresses, you have several who have to go and experience a version of this, and your depiction, you achieved your goal of not making it sort of titillating in any way.
Yeah.
It's just horrifying. Mm-hmm. But
How does that conversation go?
There was a lot of talk beforehand. Nudity riders are very specific about what exactly you'll be seeing and what the shots were. They knew what every shot was going to be. And there was room for everyone to say if they felt uncomfortable. And I actually want to give huge credit to the actor, Blake Ellis, who played the rapist, because that was not an easy job. And he did his performance extremely well, and it's horrifying. And his demeanor on the set was incredibly generous. And I think his attitude...
Can you explain just a little what that means, generous?
I think he would make sure that the actor he was working with was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he was relaxed.
Had a sort of a I come in peace vibe when he wasn't shooting.
Yeah, and between takes, he would relax and he would, you know, laugh and chat with you. And I mean, it takes a long time to move a camera and stuff, so you don't stay in the intensity
over and over
of
again,
assault
right?
that long. And then at a certain point, it's the work and you got to get the shots and everybody knows what they are and you do it.
Yeah, you did do it.
Yeah.
And then you have another story, which is the, I guess, I hate to use it, it sounds so cliche, the empowering aspect where these two women are on a mission.
Yeah, I mean, it's propulsive, which is great because it gives, just as a storyteller, it gives you an engine to keep powering through. And it's hard. It's hard to watch people in pain. But I thought that this really dynamic story about these two detectives who, you know, find themselves in a sea of leads and they have no idea which is going to lead them anywhere. And their collaboration and then the relationship that built, all that felt like it had enough energy that drew you toward it, that it left room to look candidly at the genuine pain of Marie's story.
One of the most enraging things, of course, and without giving away plot points that I think people should have revealed if they haven't seen the series, the fact that this perpetrator was discovered as a serial rapist at all was a complete fluke. And the fact that Marie was tied to this in a different state, complete fluke.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely enraging.
Well, I mean, what it tells you is how many Maries are out there that nobody has
connected the dots.
Connected, and how many people are chasing side-by-side rapists without any awareness that they're looking for the same guy. District sharing information is a really big problem in law enforcement. So, yeah, it's a fluke, but it also tells you that these things go unseen all the time.
I mean, I hope that there might be some changes because of this.
Well, I wouldn't say it's because of this. We've partnered with some people who are doing really good advocacy on this front. There's a group called the End Violence Against Women International. I think they're all former detectives who are advocates now, and they're working on streamlining the reporting process so that a victim doesn't have to tell her story five times, and the information sharing. You know, they're working on all these fronts.
It could make a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's been on Netflix as we're speaking for a bit, a little bit now, and there's a lot of conversation. I assume this is, the feedback is amazing.
And it's been good. It's been really positive. There was an article in Vanity Fair that flatteringly put us in the company of Chernobyl and When They See Us, which are two fine, great pieces of work, but under the umbrella of what they called must endure TV.
Oh, okay.
The new wave of must endure TV.
That sounds appealing.
But, you know, I just think it's, especially with younger people, I feel such eagerness to have those gnarly conversations about things that we've been ignoring. They're inheriting a tough world, you know, and they all seem to realize that it's not going to get better without looking at it. So but it's nice to feel that in response to work we did. It's really heartening.
Writer and director Susanna Grant is the showrunner and executive producer for the Netflix series Unbelievable. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.